We're double A. Kyle's doing a good job.
Oh, okay. Are we ready?
All right.
The House Committee on Revenue for March 19th, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 611. I understand there's no one signed up for 611. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 611, open a work session on House Bill or Senate Bill 611. Kyle, do you want to tell us where we are? And we'll get going on this. And please.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, we should have momentarily an OLS dash 11 amendments. So they should be being loaded up right now. So you may need to refresh your screen here
okay.
a couple of times.
Great.
We should have those. And along with that, we do have the paperwork, so the revenue impact is up there and the fiscal is there. And we also have some information that we can walk through to help explain. There's some on the Angros bill and then also what the changes under the dash 11 would do. So depending on how you want to proceed, we can go through the SMS, or we also have a document up there called Key Elements that has the bill as it is today. So it has the A and gross changes, and then also the dash 11 are in there as well. And that's
dash 11 just came up on my system.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I think you're going to talk for a while, so why don't you put it in whatever order makes the most sense to you, and as members arrive, they'll hear more and more of it.
Okay, excellent. So I will, just as for anyone who wants to refer just to the changes, you can check in the SMS, but I'm going to go ahead and walk through to start the SB 611 key elements. So we can go through what's in the bill, and then also I'll try to highlight as I do that what are the new components from the dash 11.
Great, thank you.
So for with the dash 11, the way that 611 is set up is we've been trying to think of this as really three tiers of exemptions, or yeah, three tiers of changes to existing law. So the first two, tier one and tier two, relate to exemptions, and the third tier really has to do with how data centers, whether or not they're subject to central assessment, some changes there. So starting with the tier one, which is the first bullet up there in the key elements, there are the changes to the bill are there's a number of exemptions that we put into place for companies subject to central assessment. So the first, there just as a reminder, there is one existing exemption right now that's on the books that was added, I believe, in 2001 related to the value of FCC licenses. So added to that exemption that's existing would be an exemption related to the booked value of franchises. And one of the changes in the dash 11 from what was passed out of the Senate is that exemption language would, what came out of the Senate was it would be applied, the value of your franchises would be applied against the assessed value of a company. So it'd be, you'd apply the reduction based on assessed value. The changes in the dash 11 would make that consistent where the exemption would be applied at the real market value of the company. And the reason that can be important is goes back to Measure 50. And in some cases, companies or property owners, for that matter, may not be assessed at their real market value. So they can have a real market value, and then the tax is actually applied to their assessed value. And they can be one and the same, but in some cases, they can also, the assessed value can be a lower value than the real market value. So if you apply an exemption to the assessed value, you would reduce the value of the property from the assessed value. However, if you apply it to the real market value, it brings the RMV down. And it'll bring, if the RMV comes below the company's assessed value, then that difference between the RMV minus the exemption from the assessed value is the actual value that's removed from the roll. So, and we can get to the, or we'll get to the revenue impact in a little bit, but you'll see that's reflective in the change of the revenue impact. There's a less of a loss for, connected to the bill because of that. So that's the second exemption. Another one that's in there is for the value of satellites, and if the satellites have to be used, if I can get the language, in communication directly to retail customers. And these exemptions, the third exemption is this cap, and we've talked a little bit about this, related to the historic cost of a company multiplied by 130%. So it's kind of a secondary calculation, and the idea with this one is to provide some level of relief to companies that may have a high level of intangibles compared to tangible value that come under central assessment. And this is one of the exemptions that is would be broad, and it's available to all companies. It really depends on the company's structure and how much their intangible value is compared to their tangible value on whether or not they would see any benefit from that exemption. And with these exemptions, I should note, especially with the historic cost times 130%, there has been some confusion there. If for some reason it doesn't, a company runs, these calculations are done, if there's no benefit to the company, there's no increase in tax. They would just continue on with the current law assessment, so to say. So there's no chance that a tax increase will happen. These are all possible tax relief options to the company. And there's language in the bill, if you're taking one of these three exemptions, you can only take one. You can't take multiple, the only exception being FCC licenses that are connected to the value of a satellite. So that's the one case where you can use multiple exemptions. But otherwise, if you're taking an FCC license exemption, you can't also take a franchise exemption. And then there's also one other note, is there is a floor provision for the historic cost times 130%. There was some worry that using this calculation, there could be an opportunity, dependent upon a specific structure of a company, that could have their historic cost could be zero because maybe they're leasing something that is exempt. So there is a floor equal to 5% of the total Oregon value for these companies. So no company would have their tax reduced to zero.
We're talking about small special cases, aren't we?
Yes, the ones we've only identified, or it's almost even more of a hypothetical,
okay,
as well. But that pretty much covers the Tier 1 exemptions. The Tier 2 relates to this special exemption for qualified projects. And this is in, I believe, it begins with Section 5 of the bill. But what this does, the idea for this exemption is for a company that meets specific requirements, so it's investment in communication infrastructure, they would be an exemption would be available to them. Now, the way the exemption works is it's going to be based upon $250 million or the total real market value of tangible, real, and personal property. So the idea would be the basis from which your taxes are applied, and the exemption would cover more or less the intangible value that is above that. So the company would be taxed on their tangible value here in Oregon. It's kind of the underlying factor. Now, there's certain requirements for the application process that a company would have to meet. These are overseen by PUC in working with the Department of Revenue as well. There's some language in there that would require reporting to the legislature on the benefit of these exemptions. And some of the changes that we've seen in the Dash 11, or quite a number of them, are related to this Tier 2 exemption that becomes available. And bear with me one second while I get to that.
Mr. Chair?
Sorry, who wanted to be? Representative Leininger, please.
I am not able to access that document. You had mentioned that it had just come up on your computer. Do we have a hard copy of that?
The key elements.
Yeah, the new key elements. I only have the prior key elements.
Could I have one too?
Thanks.
If you refresh your browser, you might get it.
Yeah, no, I have been.
Okay.
So, thanks.
It is, okay. Get a printed copy.
Great. Why don't you go?
I don't know if there's other. Okay.
Anyone else having that difficulty? Oh.
I mean, I'm just reading it off the screen.
Yes,
okay.
I can't find it on here either.
All right. Well, let's make sure we get printed copies for those two. It came up fine on my computer, and I'm usually the one who has the problem. So,
you don't have
a note. Kyle, why don't you go ahead, and we'll get printed copies for the two members who can't seem to bring it up quick. Three members who can't bring it up quickly.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair. So, continuing on with the Tier 2. So, the changes. There's really three primary changes. The first is the communication property that would qualify for this exemption. The new language would require the company to be able to offer, have the capacity to provide 1 gigabit of symmetrical service.
Yeah.
to a majority of residential customers of the company's broadband services. And so there's a couple changes in there from what was in existing law, and part of that was, the first one was the capacity issue to provide gigabit service.
I only have the amendment.
And the reason for that was, you would build the network to have the capacity to it, but not every customer may choose to acquire that faster capacity. So as long as the network's available to them, they could qualify for this, but the customers don't necessarily have to be using that speed. Perhaps they want to purchase a lower speed or something to that nature. So that was the first change there, along with, and then the service, there was some change in the language to what the service territory is. So that is the residential, majority of the residential customers of the company's broadband services. There's a requirement that a company does not deny access to the communication infrastructure to any group of residential customers solely because of income. And then there's also an added new addition is a requirement the Public Utility Commission, while there's a period after they receive the application when they're working through to make sure that the company qualifies or not, during that time period they will consult with any city that has franchise agreement with the company. So that even if a company is going to invest in City A, the PUC would consult with the city and kind of let them know what's going on there, so they're aware of the discussions. So those are the three new requirements, the primary new requirements in the Tier 2 language.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Davis.
What section of the bill are those in?
Representative Davis.
Or the amendment, I apologize.
Yeah, we're looking at the A11 amendment at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, so we can step through it in Section 5. It's subsection 2A and B. Is the new language, so that's on page 3, or beginning on page 3.
Thank you.
And then section 6 also has some, covers that, the tier 2 as well. And then the last, the tier 3, there's a, which relates to data centers. We still have the existing language that protects a company that really has most of that would normally be subject to central assessment. If really their only footprint in the communication category is a data center, then they would not be subject to central assessment. So it avoids data center property pulling a company into central assessment. There is a limit there of no more than 10% of property that is not data center property is what the company can have. So they can have a little bit of property on the side that would be communication property, but so long as it doesn't go above that 10% limit, they wouldn't be subject to central assessment. So that's existing language, and there isn't really any change to that section. What was changed is that data or companies subject to central assessment, if they have data center property that is valued, and when I say value, this is related to the historic cost of it, but for simplification purposes, if it's valued at more than $200 million, and that's statewide, so if you sum up all the value of their data centers and that equals more than $200 million, that those data centers would not be subject to central assessment, even if that company is otherwise subject to central assessment. So if it's a communication company and they have communication property and data center property, if all those data centers sum to more than $200 million, the data centers would be locally assessed. They're not exempt. They're just locally assessed. They're not subject to central assessment.
Okay.
And that's the
okay.
And that kind of rounds up the changes.
Do we know whether that has effect on the taxes paid by existing Oregon businesses?
Mr. Chair, as of right now, the data centers that we see are receiving exemption under local exemption. So we have the enterprise zone and the SIP agreement are still allowed for companies. Those are two exemptions that can still be applied. It potentially could down the road, certainly as we've had testimony of companies interested in investing more in data center property, so we could see some of these existing companies do that and get over that $200 million
okay.
Going forward.
And it would apply in the event that those other exemption agreements expire, I assume.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's one thing we've seen is a number of data centers that are there, the threshold is maybe 3 or 4 years before they'll be coming. They could potentially be subject to central assessment. There's still some question out there of whether that data center it's the use of the data center. So if the data center exists, but it's not used for communication purposes, it's not subject to central assessment. It's right. Only if it supports the communication purposes.
Yes. Okay. So, but there are a number of companies, we believe, that are considering adding data centers in Oregon, and those would come under this rule.
Yes.
Potentially.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's the provisions related to data centers take effect July 1st, 2015, where the exemption language comes into effect July 1st, 2016. So it would part of that is to, because we've heard about this investment that could be coming in, the data center portion comes into effect a year prior.
More quickly.
Yes.
All right. I don't know if you're finished with the explanation or not, because, I mean, I've been asking you questions. I'm sure other people have some as well.
That's what I have prepared for, kind of a run-through.
The run-through, yeah. Okay. So questions for Kyle about what this bill, I mean, everyone's seen the original bill, but the A11s is really a conglomeration of several different ideas that we think will accomplish the goals that we've already been discussing. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you. There was some concern expressed about the definition on gigabit. Is that in here someplace?
Yes.
Where is that?
Can you tell us where that? I think it's under Section 5, isn't it?
It's on line 27.
Yeah. Of what page?
Page 3.
Page 3. Line 27, according to Representative Reed.
Yes.
Just lucky to see it first.
And yes, there was originally early on in the bills, there was gigabyte. And I think that was some of the concern, as gigabyte and gigabit are two different things.
Yeah. One's 10 times bigger than the other.
Yes.
Yes. So. But usually internet service speeds are measured in bits rather than bytes. It's my understanding. Okay. Did you find it?
Page 3, line 20.
Yeah,
there it is.
Yeah. And one of the issues that came up yesterday, I think, was the concern that if the service was available that had the capacity of more than 1 gigabit, then it wouldn't qualify. So we made a small change in the language to say that we're talking about capacity of at least 1 gigabit to deal with that potential issue. Yes, please, Representative Banks.
Thank you. And, Cal, there's a reference to if you take one exemption, you don't get another. Can you define for us exemptions? Which exemptions are then you precluded from taking if you take whichever one you're allowed in here?
Yes, Representative Bentz. So the only ones that are allowed is you can still take the enterprise zone or enterprise zones, I guess, or zone exemptions and the SIP exemption, the strategic investment. What it's referring to in here would be the franchise, the new exempt franchises, satellites, and then also the existing one under current law for FCC licenses. And then also the historic cost cap would be another one. So that was part of the reasoning is if you do this historic cost cap and it comes up with a lower value and receive an exemption there, you can't then add on your FCC licenses below there.
Got it.
And the same thing applies for the Tier 2 as well. If you're getting the Tier 2, you can get those local ones, but you can't then add on other existing ones.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And I'm looking at Section 5, 7A, lines 9 through 12. Is that what you're talking about?
That's on page 6.
Page 6.
Yes. Representative Vance, yes, that is the language there.
It's not the one with the...
Okay, so whatever the exemptions are in 5, if you choose any of those, then you don't get anything else. That's what this means,
right?
Isn't it?
Yes, and okay. if you for some reason a company doesn't qualify for this Tier 2, but they do make an investment, but they just don't qualify, they could still then avail themselves to the existing exemptions. So they could get a benefit from the franchise ones if they're not in under this Tier 2 language. So that's kind of the first test would be like, well, do you qualify under the Tier 2? No, we don't. Well, then you can still check the Tier 1 exemptions. and see which ones would apply to you.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
Could you explain the term symmetrical service? That was on line 27, page 3, versus asymmetrical.
Can you explain that?
I can do my best shot. Okay. My understanding of it's just upload and download speeds. Okay. So in some cases, those can be two different speeds.
Okay. Yeah.
My current internet provider provides me with, I think, 40 megabits coming toward my computer and 3 or 3.5 going away. That would be asymmetrical.
Right.
If it were symmetrical, I'd get 46 both directions.
How common is it for them to be symmetrical then? Is it just this one case that we're looking at? The upload and download being that of that magnitude?
It's my understanding that mostly that's currently used by businesses that want to run their own servers so that they can actually send material out at the same speed that they can bring things in. Most of us, of course, if we're just using a computer, what we're sending out is basically requests for new pages. So it doesn't take much. But when you're running a server, you want to be able to send out material at very significant speeds because other people are asking for it. So mostly it's businesses. Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, in section under the tier two again, there was some testimony about kind of the impact of this on new structures versus existing structures. Does this deal with that at all in any sort of, is that where the symmetry comes from?
Representative Smith Warren, I believe what it would relate to, any company could potentially qualify for it. There is a requirement in there that it would be the majority of the broadband customers. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be kind of the limiting factor that an existing company would have to meet that to qualify. But there was some language in there about equal price and such things, and that's been removed. But it tried to clarify that, yes, an existing company, if they meet the requirements, can receive this exemption. Yeah.
Thank you. I think that's right. Yeah.
Other questions? Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Leininger.
So I'm trying to get a handle on the extent to which the narrowing reflected in this amendment reduces the revenue hit to affected jurisdictions. I want to make sure I understand it correctly. Could you describe for me, in your words, what you see as the reduction in scope?
So let's go ahead and move on to the topic then of the revenue impact. And why don't you go ahead and compare the A11, assuming that were adopted, with the bill as it came from the Senate? Because I think that's the question you're asking.
That is exactly
the question. And then we can come back to discussion of A11 itself later if you want to. Kyle, can you point to where that document is?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the A11 is up on, or the revenue impact. Let me see which one it is. It is up there. It's the SB 611 A11 RIS, I guess. So it is under the meeting materials for today. And we have that. That's what's it's up on the screen there. So, yeah, I don't have the original one. I probably should have brought that one up. But, yes, the narrowing of the exemption, primarily it'd be the language related to the franchise exemption, instead of being applied at the assessed value but being moved back to the RMD, is reflected in these changes here. So if my memory serves, the total revenue loss for 16-17 under the A engrossed version was $16.2 million, and now we're looking at about $7.8 million for the first year. And then it's roughly, I want to say like 47, not quite 50, a little less than 50% of the previous estimate. And part of that going forward is by making the change of putting the exemption at an RMV level rather than assessed value, is there is this fluctuation in companies' RMV. So if you're applying exemption to assessed value, the value of the revenue loss or the value of the property that then would be applied to the tax rates to calculate the revenue loss is just going to be the value of the the booked value of the franchises for the company, because it's being taken off of assessed value. So whether that's going up or down, that would going forward affect the previous revenue impact, where today, with the real market value, the fluctuation of the real market value of a company and its relation to its maximum assessed value can dictate a little bit the exemption that would be available or the actual revenue loss. And that's a very long way of explaining why the growth isn't quite as much in the dash 11 revenue impact compared to what is out there for the engrossed.
Right. The original revenue impact is available if you go to the bill and then look under the bill materials. It's there from the Senate, dated 227, I think, if that's the one that we're talking about. And it shows a fiscal impact, total revenue loss for 16-17 of $16.2 million, whereas the one that Kyle just talked about shows a loss of $7.8 million net for this, for the current biennium. And I think that's what you were referring to, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. It's in OLIS. You have to look a little bit for it because it's under the Senate hearing rather than ours.
Yes, and the same language in the impact explanation is there for going forward. What's not included in this revenue impact would be some of that tier two, and then also an expansion of maybe of data centers as well that could qualify for existing exemptions. So the estimate is based upon what we know today, and then going forward, if a number of companies were to come in here and build out these communication networks, the revenue loss that you would see that would show up in the tax expenditure report published by the governor's office could be quite different than what you see here, but that would be in response to some property being built and qualifying for the tier two exemption primarily. There could be some for data centers as well. But that's just as kind of a note there on what could happen potentially. And this is kind of similar to what we see with the SIP program as well, where the revenue impact might have been smaller, but then it spurred such investment that now it looks much larger than originally.
Does that deal with your question?
Yes, thank you. I just want to make an observation.
Please.
I think this is a really significant decrease in the revenue impact. I mean, taking it from potential 33.5 million impact to down to 16 million by narrowing the scope of the this bill language is really important at a time when we're trying to make sure that we have adequate funding for a lot of other needs. So thank you for clarifying it, and thanks everyone who worked on this.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions about this? I would note that from a standpoint of the were you planning to, let me, before I say what I was going to say, were you planning to talk about the effective tax charts?
I can, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you do that, too? The effective tax charts are the second item on the list of measure details for today. Let me simply note that on Monday I asked a number of questions of witnesses about the effective tax rates, and nobody could answer the question. So I asked the Legislative Revenue Office, and Kyle in particular, to see if he could derive that information for us. And he worked very hard over several days to prepare the chart that we have in front of us under document 54841. Do you want to describe that a little bit for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just before, so I don't forget, also mention on the revenue impact, this would be an expansion or create or extend or expand a tax expenditure. So there is a policy purpose statement at the bottom of that revenue impact
Thank
statement.
You.
So I'd encourage people to take a look at that and provide any feedback, I suppose, if that's not the purpose that the committee sees.
Right. One of our rules, of course, I think it's a statute now, isn't it? Actually requires LRO to prepare this explanation. And so if we have some criticisms of that, we should let them know today. Because that's the way in which this kind of thing ends up in the tax expenditure report.
Can we borrow you outside?
Oh, okay.
So Yes. So moving on to the effective rate charts, that is in...
If we could,
yeah.
Mr. Kyle, can you go back to the... You asked us to look at the policy purpose of this measure is to provide tax relief. So before we leave that, are you taking us now to show us exactly how that just happened by virtue of this bill? In other words, is that what we're looking up there going to show us what the purpose language reflects?
No, Representative Benz. It could be helpful, I guess, but it's more this is... I just wanted to note that before I forgot to make sure that that was brought forward to the committee for review. But it's they can be related, but not directly. This isn't a direct relation to the policy purpose.
So my hope is that you will be able to say in general terms how we reach that policy purpose before we leave it. Because it says the purpose is to provide tax relief for centrally assessed companies, primarily with those with high levels of intangible value and to create an environment that incentivizes. So the bill is complex. There's a lot of stuff going on inside it. So to the extent that you can call out how this bill achieves that result, that would be helpful.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that before moving on, certainly.
Please, that's
so the way the bill is structured, and we had some examples, and they are in OLIS on the Senate side, and I can definitely provide them. But
thank you.
The exemptions included in this bill, with the exception of the one for satellites, which is actually a tangible piece of property, but it's used with intangible FCC licenses. So, but all the exemptions in the bill are relating to providing relief for intangible. So it's exempting an intangible piece of property, whether it's a franchise or this historic cost times 130% is meant to be used in some ways as, I don't know if it's necessarily a direct proxy for tangible property compared to intangible, but it will provide relief for companies that have high level of intangible property in relation to their tangible property. And some of the examples we showed on the Senate side that can really illustrate two companies providing the same service and really having the same level of tangible property here in Oregon, dependent upon what their global intangible versus tangible property is and the way that gets assessed under central assessment, could result in rather stark differences in the tax that would be levied or the taxable value of the property. And in some cases, dependent on, especially for some of the newer communication companies or the companies that are getting into the field of communication, we've run into instances or used examples that are very realistic examples that could be 5, 6, 10 times the level of tax that would be owed based upon a company's structure and how much intangibles they have. And that's, I think that's kind of the idea behind the policy purpose, is really everything in the bill is in many ways directed at providing some level of relief from taxation that is really resulting from the central assessment, which includes intangibles, as opposed to local assessment, which is only based on the tangible value of a property.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry to have missed a little piece of that. One of the comments I wanted to make was that because we didn't have any testimony on the issue of the effective tax rates, I asked Kyle to do this chart. What it demonstrated was that a very small change in the bill could actually levelize the effective tax rates considerably. Given the other exemptions which already exist, I'm thinking primarily the FCC exemption, there's no way to get there within the scope of this bill to get to an absolutely levelized system. But this account, this what we end up with in the last column here is one that is at least roughly levelizes the different modalities of communications, taking into account the fact that some of these companies have considerably more intangible property than others. And so while this is not, I wouldn't claim that this is, that we've absolutely solved that problem, at least we're at a point where taxation should not be give a competitive advantage to one modality over a different modality. And that was part of my goal when I was asking those questions on Monday. Kyle, did you have other things you wanted to go over about the bill or about the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's a need to walk through some of the information on the chart not, or if there's any notes or questions. The first thing is just, I just want to put out there is all the information that's contained within here. There were some questions about specific companies that were asked when they were at the witness stand, and that's why there's four companies listed there. but this really is a simulation and estimate process. It doesn't take into account the actual taxes paid by companies, because depending upon your location, you could pay different various tax rates, so that wouldn't really get to an effective tax rate comparison. And the information here is from publicly available documents, for the ones, at least for the calculation of the franchise exemption and how that affects the rates. So this information here may not match up precisely to what's used in the revenue impact statement, but because that's confidential, all this is coming from either the public roll, which is available for the RMV and the AV, or the values reported on the company's financial report. So primarily the 10K SEC filing is where I pulled these figures from.
All right, Representative Pence, please.
Thank you. And thank you for questioning this form. It's extremely interesting. The question, I guess, Kyle, is do we have any idea how those rates in the final column stack up against other states?
Representative Vance, I did not look at how that happens. Another big note on this is in the question of parity between companies, Measure 50 plays a very large role. So depending upon the RMV and the AV of a company, because of what's in the Constitution of Measure 50, getting to parity may not exist from the very start, regardless of any exemptions that are put out there. Just if one company is taxed at their RMV and another company is taxed at their AV, which is maybe 80% of RMV, there's a difference just inherent in the system right from the get-go.
Thank you.
And, of course, that's the special circumstance that Oregon faces that no one else faces. No one else has a Measure 50. So some states have dealt with intangibles simply by ignoring them. That probably isn't an option for us as long as Measure 50 is on the books, if we're going to try to get to a levelized playing field for businesses. Other questions or comments? Are we ready for motions? I don't see objections to that. Representative Benson, we will need a rule suspension if we're going to vote on the A11s now. They were posted at 10 after 1, and the hour that's required by the rule has not passed.
I think we're going to say yes, but I'd rather have a little recess and go ask my team.
Fine. We will stand at ease for a couple minutes, and we'll be back. The committee will stand at ease. Okay. We're back on the record, and we're on a work session on Senate Bill 611. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules to allow a vote on A11 before 2:10 p.m.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves to suspend the rule requiring one hour's notice for a vote on an amendment. Is there any objection to the motion to suspend the rules? Hearing none, the rules are suspended. Representative Benz?
Sir, Chair, I move Senate Bill. The amendment. A11 be adopted.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the A11 amendment be adopted to Senate Bill 611. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Discussion, yes.
Please.
Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. You know, I've had concerns about this bill because of the size of the revenue impact at a time when we're working hard to find resources for other key services. But I do think, obviously, one of the most important ways to get revenue is to have good jobs throughout the state. And I'm pleased that we've significantly narrowed the revenue impact. You know, the 17-19 biennium numbers that we just saw take it from a 33.5 million estimate to a 16 million estimate, and I'm going to be balancing the different factors. I'm going to be a yes on this, but I would like to note that I think going forward it would be helpful for us to promote the transparency and ability for everyone in the community to understand what we're using these resources for, to have an even more express purpose reflected in complicated legislation like this. I'm pleased that we had a conversation about that just now, the specific deliverables, how we'll know if we're getting what the thing is that we think that we're going to encourage through this set of decisions. I like the idea reflected in some of the legislation before us that businesses that avail themselves of tax incentives or breaks or special tax treatment will have more transparency around the taxes that they do pay to support state services. And then a sunset period, you know, in case this isn't working out as we might have hoped, to make it more easy to pivot. So while on balance, I'm going to be a yes, I'd like to see us going forward incorporate more of that kind of language in future work, and I hope we'll look carefully at some legislation that would do that that's going to be before us this session.
Thank you, Representative. Other discussion on the A11 amendment? I don't see any other discussion. Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment with the proviso we've already heard? I haven't. Okay. I don't see any objection. The amendment, the A11 amendment is adopted. Representative Bentz?
Chair, I move Senate Bill 611 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves Senate Bill 611 to the floor, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Bentz, please.
Sure. I would just say the bill is a interesting grouping of improvements and not so much improvements. A lot more work to be done. I understand the value that this bill brings to the state of Oregon in the context of attracting larger businesses here. But I look forward at some point to addressing some of the issues that still remain unresolved by this bill. But there's a lot of good in it, and I'm hopeful that the incentives we're providing will operate the way we hope they will operate and bring more jobs and economic activity to the state.
Thank you. Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to reflect briefly upon the value of certainty over perfection sometimes when it comes to our tax treatment, that providing certainty to those who might be on our shores, so to speak, of the Columbia River and elsewhere wanting to come into the state of Oregon to do business is of great value. And it's for that reason I'll be supporting this bill. Even if it may not be eternally perfect, we would all agree that every piece of our tax system needs a little bit of tweaking in that regard. But to the extent we can provide certainty and therefore entice and incentivize those to come to our state to create jobs, to fund our public services, I will be supporting the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other comments? Yeah, Representative Whitsitt, please.
I'd just like to make a statement regarding the method to which we are getting our information. This is a really big bill. This is a lot of information. We don't even have the information available on OLIS as we sit in our committees today. And I find that disturbing somewhat, that we are asked to come and make these huge decisions and we do not have the information in front of us in time to really go through it in a proper manner. So I'm a yes, but I'm very concerned about how things are being thrown at us basically without proper time to go through them.
Thank you. Just a quick comment on that. I appreciate the point you're making. I think it's a very important point. This committee deals with very complex issues all the time and must be data-driven. I mean, it has to be if we're going to do our work well. The more information we have that helps us to understand the real world and what the bills actually do is really important to us. And so I really appreciate that comment. I think one of the issues for this bill and one of the reasons why we're trying to move it along as quickly as we reasonably can is, again, because of business exigencies having to do with decisions that are made by other parties that we don't have any control over, and attempts to make certain that Oregon both provides the certainty that Representative Davis was talking about and also an attractive business environment for companies that would like to make investments here. If I thought the bill was not ready to go forward, I wouldn't have opened the work session today, and you'll have my assurance that I won't open work sessions on bills that I don't think are ready. I would also add that a bill this complex always has issues. There are always things in it that, in a bill this complicated, that on reflection we think we wish we'd have done a different way. I have been, in the discussions I've had with the chair of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, we expect that there will be follow-on legislation this session to continue to fine-tooth comb this bill, to deal with the specific issues that people raise that are of concern. I certainly can't promise that they'll make any changes in the bill, but we will be working on this bill probably more than we do other complex bills, simply because it has generated such a large amount of interest. But let me just simply say that on behalf of the committee, I apologize for the fact that information has arrived late, and we are doing the best we can. The information that we used in order to craft this amendment did not become available to your chair until yesterday afternoon. And so we've been moving as fast as we can on it, and I appreciate your objections, your concerns. Any other, Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to reiterate my thanks to you and to the LRO staff on all the hard work that you did on this bill, that I think it has made a significant difference. I think that your insistence on a framework of comparison between across this ever-changing part of the economy that is kind of evolving almost by the moment, and trying to do the best we can to make sure that there is all the fairness that we can establish. And also, and I look forward to our being able to do similar things with making sure that that we are able to kind of tighten and really narrow down exemptions and work on fairness across the board. And so I thank you for that.
Thank you. Other discussion? The motion is to send the bill to the floor with a due pass. Is there any objection? Without objection, the motion carries. Thank you very much. I'll carry the bill, and with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 611. Are we ready on the public hearings? Paul, which ones do we have the most witnesses on for today? We have four bills and probably 45 minutes. We may not have time to get through them all. So,
Mr. Chair, while he's answering that, yeah. I realize that I've been booked for another important meeting. So if you want to carry mine over or carry my testimony,
which one is yours?
2749, that would be fine with me. If that makes your job easier.
You want to move it to Monday?
That's fine.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I also mentioned that on House Bill 2961, the sponsors of that have talked with them, and they asked to move that to Tuesday.
Tuesday. Okay.
So that's
getting easier.
It's getting easier. We're having a little bit of triage.
All right. Well, yeah. While we're talking about it, then let me just say that we will move the public hearing on House Bill 2749 to Monday, and so that will be a carryover. And we will move the public hearing on House Bill 2961 to Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. That's already been posted.
That's already been posted for Tuesday? Okay, yes. That's posted. So now we're down to HJR 19 and House Bill 3177. What do we have here? Lots of people on 3177.
Right. And one on 19.
One on 19. All right. Let me take a look at this. All right. So we're not going to hear. Wait a minute. Which one is this?
This is 3177.
Okay. All right. So we'll announce that we're not going to hear House Bill 3177 today. And that comes off the agenda. We'll open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 19.
Okay.
Paul?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. HJR 19 is a reserve fund bill. And what the bill does is it puts the Oregon Rainy Day Fund, reserve fund, into the Constitution. It's a joint resolution. And the characteristics of that fund are the same as the Education Stability Fund. It's the current constitutional fund. So it has the same requirements for withdrawal. The key element of this is the method by which there are deposits into the fund. And that has to do with the an estimate of the amount of revenue from income and corporate excise taxpayers, And that is done on a 2-year basis, and that average amount is based on a trend. And when that trend is exceeded, then the revenue is put into the reserve fund and then into this Oregon Rainy Day Fund. I did want to point out on your OLIS that we have a report from the Pew Charitable Trusts, and this is something that we have followed closely, and we've looked at some other information from them, but this is a report that just came out last week, and so I put it in there. It's managing volatile tax collection state revenue forecasts, and basically very germane to the idea of reserve funds. So I put that out there for your information.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Reed, did you want to speak on this bill?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would be happy to, and I can do it here or either way.
Either way, whatever works best, I think it's fine.
Thank you. I think I would just say to the committee, this is a consistent theme for me, as all the returners will know, my interest in boosting our reserve funds. This is one way to do it. You and I, in various combinations, other members of the committee and the legislature had lots of discussions about this. This is another option for us. I think there's value in creating the general purpose rainy day fund in the Constitution to go alongside the existing Constitutional Education Stability Fund with a well-established set of triggers. And in this case, one way of making our deposits and contributions to that reserve fund more robust and more regular. Lots more to talk about in this general topic. Another way of doing that in the bill that we've set over till Monday as well.
Okay. Now, questions for Representative Reed? Let me ask mine then. Is this a new reserve fund? A new constitutional reserve fund, or is this an amendment of one we already have?
Mr. Chair, I think it's a new one.
Okay.
What my understanding, and I'm happy to be corrected by Paul or others, is that it would establish the what is now a statutory general purpose rainy day fund as a constitutional general purpose rainy day fund.
Okay. And the criteria under which the legislature can act, are they similar to ones we are already using for other purposes?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think they are, if I'm not mistaken, I don't have every one of them completely committed to memory. I think they mirror the Education Stability Fund.
Yep. Paul?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. In fact, that same criteria exists for the statutory Oregon Rainy Day Fund, with the exception of the governor's declaration of an emergency. So we have that same language around the economic triggering, and even the statutory language does require 3/5. From the statutory, even though that obviously doesn't have the same teeth as a constitutional provision.
And Mr. Chair, I would note that there is sometimes a tendency in this building to have a different definition around emergency, but in this case, line 21, the governor has declared an emergency exists related to an earthquake, a tsunami, or another natural disaster, or an act of war. It's a very specific sort of emergency.
Volcanic eruption.
That might be another natural disaster, yes.
Another is rather broad.
Another.
So it wouldn't be an emergency for that purpose, at least, if we just happen to think like maybe we ought to take the money.
Correct, Mr.
Right.
Chair.
Okay.
Ready for your vote.
All right. And then, as I'm reading through the rest of it, it looks like most of the rest of it has to do with how the specifics are of the money are handled and interest and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Chair, around the interest. The reserve funds have been set up. The system we've used in both reserve funds is that, well, I should say for the statutory reserve fund, is it's separate and distinct from the general fund, and that the interest that is based on that balance is retained within the reserve fund, but it can be used by the Treasury for managing the cash flow of the general fund. So in other words, once a month they go through and reconcile and determine how much of that interest earning actually belongs to the rainy day fund. So it is other fund, but it can be used for cash management purposes.
I see. Right, that reduces our own interest costs in some circumstances, doesn't it?
Yes.
Right, okay, that makes sense. Is Mr. Evans here? You want to come forward, please?
And Mr. Chair, while he's getting settled, I want to listen as much as I can, but I'm going to beat a quick retreat to another meeting in a moment. It's not anything that you're about to say.
I will not take offense, Representative Reed.
Yeah, well, there's always several things going on at once.
Of course.
In this building. If you would state your name for the record and then give your testimony, we'd
absolutely
appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Matt Evans. I'm a resident of Raleigh Hills, Oregon. I'm here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. In principle, the Taxpayer Association supports the idea of a rainy day fund. After all, it's a smart move to put money aside for when in good times or when times are not as good, right? The only important things are how does the money get in there and then how does the money get out of there? Our concern with this particular bill is how the money gets in there. And we want to make sure that there are no dedicated monies that flow into rainy day funds. Instead, what should happen is legislators should decide that this is a priority for them. Rather than having some automatic amount of money that flows in there, you should be put to a decision about how much of a total budget available should be used to set aside for tougher times that may be around the corner. Secondly, we want to ensure that any funding that goes into a rainy day fund does not somehow impact what otherwise would be owed back to taxpayers in the form of the 2% kicker. It's not clear whether or not the way money flows in this particular proposal does or does not affect the kicker. We would like to see an affirmative statement, and I'm sorry that Representative Reed had to leave since he's a sponsor of the bill, that is not the intention somehow, is to transfer money that will, instead of coming out of other areas of state government, will instead come off the top of dollars that are owed to the taxpayers of the state under the Constitution of the state. So those are the only comments that I make. I realize we only have, I think we only have one witness, myself, and Representative Reed, so I don't want to belabor your time. I do thank you for the opportunity to make comments. I'd be happy to take any questions if there are any.
Thank you. Well, you've raised a couple of questions for us about the bill. Any questions for Mr. Evans? Thank you. Paul, can you describe for us a bit the answer? I don't think there is an answer to the first question. It looks like it's money that's appropriated by the legislature. It goes into the account. It doesn't indicate where it would come from otherwise, does it?
Mr. Chair, it does on the page 2, before the close of each biennium, revenue shall estimate the amount of revenue, and then receive from personal and corporate income taxes, and then determine the revenue compared with two consecutive tax years that the prior 2 years, mm-hmm. and then based on that average, that would determine the amount going in the reserve fund. There's an issue around... if you're going, if you're looking forward and making a projection, can you redirect income taxes going forward, and does that affect the kicker base? Normally, you think of the kicker as related to the general fund, and that's what it's non-corporate general fund revenue, mm-hmm. based on the close of session estimate. So theoretically, if you're at the close of session, you make an estimate of what that revenue is, mm-hmm. And certain elements are not are not general fund. In other words, they're in this case reserve fund. They're another fund use. Then would that be counted against the kicker? So that would be one possible interpretation, that it's the amount that the general fund has budgeted. It's the revenue estimate for the general fund that's at the close of session that determines what the kicker base is. Another argument is that the Constitution also says it's the income receded to the general fund. Is income taxes always receded to the general fund, regardless of what fund you put it in? Mm-hmm. So that would be a more restrictive kind of interpretation. That would say that you can put it in any fund you want, but it's receded to the general fund initially, as income taxes are, then it counts toward the kicker.
Right.
But it's in the kicker calculation.
Of course,
so that's kind of the thing we've been discussing.
Yeah, I'm not on line 7, page 1, that the rainy day fund is established as an account in the general fund. So that may deal with that question. If it's a general fund account, then we're not talking about money that's diverted from the general fund.
Yeah. Thank you.
which I think deals with the question about the kicker. The other one is still not clear to me, the other issue, the one that you started with. They're supposed to estimate the amount of the revenue received from the personal income and corporate tax, excise tax. They're supposed to, for revenue received from personal income and corporate excise taxpayers, determine the aggregate revenue for the two consecutive tax years that begin with the year beginning January 1 of the even year that falls during the immediate preceding biennium. Okay, determine the aggregate revenue. Calculate the average.
This you would compare the aggregate amount for 2 years compared to the prior 2 years.
Yeah.
And then the amount that of revenue exceeds what it was the prior 2 years, that amount is then transferred to the Oregon Rainy Day Fund.
Okay.
So.
All right, so under this rule, their budget would be fixed forever, and the amount above the initial biennial budget would automatically go into the rainy day fund.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be equal to the amount of revenue received in the prior two calendar years.
Ah, okay.
So it would move up.
It would move up.
But it would be set at what you received in the prior biennial.
Each time the amount that would go into the reserve fund would be the amount of the current revenue minus the amount of the revenue last time.
Exactly.
And of course, if that number was negative, then nothing would go.
Nothing would go in.
Okay.
Correct. So, but that still gets you this issue where it's receded.
Right. Representative Whitsitt.
Okay. So I just need clarification because I'm not sure I'm following it exactly right. So, would this increase the amount needed to kick the kicker? By taking this money out, would that be something that then essentially would take more money to kick the kicker because you've taken this out? Yeah. So,
well, that is what I thought we were dealing with when we answered when we looked at the top part of this bill or this
clarifying because I
which says the rainy day fund is established as an account in the general fund,
right?
The other provision in the Constitution says that it's basically increases in the general fund that are above the governor's estimate that lead to a potential kicker.
Right.
And so this doesn't take it out of the general fund. It's an account inside the general fund.
But if this is taken out as a new fund, then wouldn't you have to compensate by having that much more money in the general fund?
No, but this is in the general fund. It doesn't come out. It's in the general fund.
But, do you see what I'm asking?
Representative Whitsitt, I think that right. the issue is here is if the rainy day fund is within the general fund,
right.
Then the kicker is a revenue limit. It's based on source of funds, not use of funds. So the source of funds is the general fund, sources of funds, which is personal and corporate income taxes are part of. So that the kicker calculation would not change
as a
result of this. Mm-hmm. So you would just have to budget the amount of personal and corporate income tax revenue above, it's projected to be above what you got last biennium, would have to go to the reserve fund under this proposal.
Yeah, and I think what actually happens then under this bill, if that's what happens, is that you would deposit that amount in this reserve, in this Oregon Rainy Day Fund.
Right.
And if the increase was enough to cause a kicker, you would also have to take the kicker funds out of the next biennium's budget in order to pay the kicker refund.
Right.
Which means, in effect, you're putting money into the reserve account, which you would otherwise use to pay the kicker.
Right.
And so, therefore, you have to come up with other dollars to pay the kicker.
Right. That's
it's the opposite
after.
Of the problem you're concerned about.
Well, actually, that's what I am concerned about, but I wasn't saying it correctly.
Okay.
So ultimately, it affects the kicker fund by decreasing the amount that the kicker would kick.
No, it doesn't do that.
In the following years?
No, what would happen is the kicker would kick exactly the same way it does now. There would just be fewer dollars available to pay it.
Okay, yes, I'm not saying it right. There would be fewer dollars. We're saying the same thing. I'm just not saying it correctly.
The kicker never affects the current biennium the way it works now. It only affects the next biennium.
Right.
So
it would decrease the amount that ultimately goes out. Is that right?
Not in this interpretation. Interpreted as all occurring within the general fund.
If this all happens inside the general fund, then what would actually happen is you would decrease the next biennial budget by the amount necessary to pay the kicker out, and you had already decreased the amount available in the current budget because you had to have money available to put in the reserve account. So in effect, you're spending the money twice, and the extra amount comes out of the next biennium. It reduces what you can have available to spend on your programs in the next biennium.
Spending those dollars twice, I think, is an answer to all our problems, isn't it?
Well, of course you can't. You can't literally spend them twice. It just means that schools, healthcare, and public safety would get fewer dollars in the next biennium than it would otherwise get if we didn't have this rule in place. Yeah. But I think your question, Mr. Evans, was would this affect the kicker? And I think the answer is no.
Okay.
If it's within the general fund, that's definitely true.
Great.
Yeah. Other, Representative Davis.
Just to belabor it, because let's do it.
Please.
That's just fun. The heck, nothing else to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it would have been quite big had we had this in our Constitution, for example, this biennium or last biennium. If I'm estimating correctly.
The dollar amount,
for example,
would be large.
About 1.75 a billion increase this coming biennium, but it would have been an even bigger amount deposited into the general rainy day fund because you're actually taking the average of the last two previous biennium, which would be even lower than the 1.75 increase that we may experience this. So just ballpark, 2.2.
Yeah, this fund would fill up very fast.
Yeah. Like well, let's hope for. No, I'm not going to say it. Hope for an emergency.
Yes. Yeah, I think we'll have to go back to the representatives that proposed this and suggest that they may want to look at the mechanism again. One of the interesting things about this committee is that we constantly come up with discussions about issues that once you look at them very carefully simply won't work. I think that unless we've misunderstood this measure altogether, this one simply won't work. We have to come up with some other way of doing it.
You know, the comments made earlier in the previous work session, I think, feed right into what you're talking about. You're dealing with very complicated issues. I mean, Paul is an expert, and he's having a reasonably difficult time sort of explaining it in an understandable way to you all.
That's why we have Representative Bentz.
Representative Bentz, that's why he's here. Right.
Representative Bentz. Two things, Mr. Chair. First, I'm going to hazard a guess that we don't have this bill figured out, and had Representative Reed been here, he would have set us all straight. But
that's probably true.
That's his problem.
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Evans why you're here. So the kicker is, at its heart, a spending limitation device. And so if there was anything that we dreamed up that took the what otherwise would be the kicker money and threw it into a reserve account, that would be contrary to the concept of the kicker. Is that a correct statement?
That is the Taxpayer Association's belief. I mean, the voters, when they first passed it as a statute and later passed it as a constitutional amendment, believe that they were going to limit the ability of the legislature to have revenue to spend. And setting that money aside in a separate fund that reduces the amount of the kicker goes contrary to what the voters intended when it was put in the Constitution.
And the follow-up, the obvious follow-up is, so if we as legislators working within that limitation wanted to save anything, we have to do it under that 2% cap, or actually under whatever the estimate is, because the kicker kicks, that's what we've got to use and work with.
Yeah.
So we would have to save always under that level.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, I think that's exactly right. And nobody ever said your jobs were going to be easy. And making difficult choices is, I think, why the voters send you to Salem. And once in a while, you run into a session where very difficult choices have got to be made. And one of them can be, What are our priorities here? What do we think are so important that we're going to spend money on them? And some other things that maybe aren't quite as important are just going to have to wait for better times.
Yes, please.
So we've struggled, or at least I've personally struggled with replacements for that spending limitation that would, in some fashion, move us toward a more stable outcome. And the only solution that seems to be readily apparent is a savings solution. Is there some other one that you would recommend?
Well, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, I've argued in this body for 20 years that it's a matter of priority setting, honestly. I mean, my personal view, and I think the Taxpayer Association members as a whole would agree, that the state spends money on things it has no business spending money on, and on other things it spends more money than it should spend on them simply because of inefficiencies. I mean, you all know, the current popular stories about money that's been wasted by the state government and the legislature over the last couple of years, all of which could clearly have been better spent than it was. Better decision making on a spending level. And the sloughing off, if you will, of some of the things that the state government is up to allow it to focus its dollars where those dollars will do the most good for the greatest number in the state, is another possible answer to even a need for a rainy day fund or other savings account.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Thank Mr. You. Evans. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on HJR 19? Representative Whitsitt, please.
I just want to say my concern with this would be, how do we make up the money that has gone into the rainy day fund or into the rainy day fund? I mean, how do we increase our revenue to compensate for what's out? I mean, that's my concern, is where does that money come from?
Come from, yes. Thank you. Other comments? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of us appreciate the concept. The question is, what would the product look like? At what level? How much a rainy day fund is enough to meet those times, And obviously, as we talk about education and school funding and the lack of stability in our current system, I think we all can agree that something could be done better. This might be a mechanism, but again, I don't know. There could be other better solutions, yeah, too, but I'm certainly willing to have the conversation. So,
well, stay tuned, because there will be other approaches that may actually be helpful,
yeah,
to make this, get this done.
If I could add to it, just a response, yeah, to the general discussion. On House Bill 2749, which was what we moved till Monday, there is a mechanism in there that would use the estimated receipts from capital gains as a potential source. And so we have some simulations on that, and that's already in the OLA, so we can talk about that on Monday.
We'll talk about that Monday.
Might give you a better idea of another mechanism.
Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on HJR 19. And committee, thank you so much. Good work today. We'll see you on the floor tomorrow, and in committee on Monday. With that, Paul, have I done all the announcements I need?
11 cents.
I have. Okay. With that, the committee's adjourned.